All right, so we're here back in Studio 25 in Redmond, Washington on Microsoft main corporate campus. I'm Clint Wyckoff, joined today with Alan Rafuse, as well as Dave Kuula.
Yes.
So what are we here to talk about?
You know what we're going to talk about, Clint, is we are going to talk about whatever we want to talk about because we're MVPs. And what we feel like talking about today is Hyper-V operational readiness and yes. Why this is important for everybody out there.
Yep.
Beyond just taking in your training course that you'd get, what is it like to actually be a Hyper-V administrator in the wild?
Right.
You know, you want to be that guy that gets called at 4 a.m. You know, these are the types of skills that, you know, we're gonna give to you today. And our episode that we have today is strictly focused on a topic that's really near and dear to my heart, which is networking.
Right.
And so all of the network configurations that are required to build a production Hyper-V farm, which is, I think, in my opinion, is one of the most important parts, along with storage mm-hmm. and, you know, just your raw resources that you have that you're building. But networking is normally one of the places I find that customers fall down with their designs. So have you guys seen this before as well, like with, you know, other virtual environments, Clint, even in VMware? Is that important to really get your network set up properly?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, as we're all well aware, you know, virtualization, you know, the shared resources that it provides, one of the main components of that, not only being the compute as well as the storage, is getting the network configured correctly. You know, I think one of the first steps from a Hyper-V administrator perspective is making sure that you're getting, you know, the correct adapters for the physical hosts themselves, making sure that they're on the certified hardware compatibility matrix. Yeah. I know whenever I was on the VMware side of the fence, that was one of the, you know, it was hugely important, is making sure the different components, you know, are certified to operate well. The second piece of the stack, kind of going up a little bit further, is, you know, in the physical layer, is the, you know, the actual switches themselves.
Yes.
Yes.
So there's, you know, Alan, what do you see in the field? Folks typically, you know, deploying LACP, you know, standard failover teams.
It's both LACP, switch independent, mm-hmm. but I think it really depends on the switch infrastructure that you have.
Right.
And I think in a lot of organizations, that's where kind of a organizational boundary gets drawn across, mm-hmm. is you have your Hyper-V administrator who can maybe do the work or talk the talk, but he has to be able to talk to the network team
right.
to actually get it done. And you see this in typical large organizations.
Yep. Whenever I was kind of on that side of the fence, as I previously mentioned, you know, I was on the virtualization team. So anytime we needed anything done at the switching layer, now we were a Cisco Nexus shop. Right. We had 5Ks, 1Ks, as well as 9Ks at the core. And, you know, anytime I ever needed anything done, I would have to go and talk with the networking team.
Well, and I think this raises a very important point, because oftentimes you won't actually get to see, as the Hyper-V administrator, the full back-end network design, what that looks like, what the switch ports configurations look like. Because for us as administrators of the new, you know, software-defined data centers that people are wanting to build,
mm-hmm.
it's very important that you understand all of the underlying components. So, you know, networking is one of the areas that you're going to find that you're going to typically have a line drawn in the sand in an organization. Another one that I find is storage. So storage is another big one.
Right.
So,
storage is oftentimes the biggest bottleneck.
Yes.
And that is the case because, you know, one of the coolest parts of virtualization is how fast I can stand up resources, right?
Yeah.
So I can have a bare metal piece of hardware, install the hypervisor, whether that be VMware or Hyper-V. This concept really doesn't change for either one of those. But most times, you know, folks have this extra storage array lying around where they try to deploy VMs and things on it, where it's not necessarily designed to run VMs.
And it gets over-provisioned.
It gets over-provisioned very quickly. You know, you start to have extremely high latency.
Yep.
Because chances are it might, you know, not be SSD. It's spinning, you know, platter hard drives like the old school ones. And that creates problems.
But moving from the old traditional virtualization world, I'll say, you might have your storage area networks mm-hmm. with HBAs.
Right.
Physically connected. Now we're talking about running all the storage over the network. Big changes. A lot of people
Absolutely.
Are thinking just, hey, network administrator, I need this VLAN or subnet or trunk all this up. But like you're saying, if you don't understand the underlying architecture of how the switches are all connected.
Right. I mean, that can present a huge problem.
How do you troubleshoot it?
Right. The troubleshooting is one component of it, but also, you know, network attached storage. Okay. So on the Hyper-V side of the fence, you know, using SMB, SMB3 shares, scale out file server to run my virtual machines, or even on the vSphere side of the fence, is, you know, using NFS based storage devices. You know, is my switching infrastructure set up correctly to actually handle that type of, not only my production domain traffic, but also my VM traffic going back and forth. And if I need to live migrate or storage emotion those things around, you know, there can be problems that arise inside of environments if it's not architected correctly.
Well, and even along those lines, Clint, there's another really important one that, you know, I think people should have as a takeaway, is that when you're building this core infrastructure, test it before you go live in production. Test the power failure of one of your switches in the pair that's in a stack. Or if you take, if you've got a dual core design, test the failover. See how long it takes to reconverge. See if you're going to take any drops with your outages. See how much latency is going to increase in the environment. There's only one time you can legitimately test that, you know, without being in an outage window in production, and that's right at the very beginning.
Right. And, you know, kind of whenever I was doing these things, Alan, in my previous life, as I mentioned, you know, we had a specific lab that was set up much like production was, had a lot of the same network equipment. So we can go down and actually test these different types of scenarios. You know, one of the problems that, you know, you have in modern day, servers is, you know, what if I have a single path down, right? Now that can either be a, you know, part of the networking stack, it can be part of the storage stack. Is my multipathing driver set up correctly? Is the storage array itself correct? You know, there's a lot of different areas
CSVs
there.
CSVs can be redirected mode or?
Yep.
There's a lot of different things. So I think from an administrator perspective, if you take nothing out of, you know, this networking component that we're going to be sharing here with you is, you know, test. I think that's hugely important and something that oftentimes gets overlooked.
Absolutely. All right, guys. Well, we hope you guys enjoy the this episode on Hyper-V operational training, the networking component. And as always, any comments, feedback, anything like that, there's a comment option right on the bottom of the video. We look forward to hearing from all you. Thank you guys very much.
Awesome.
Thank you.
All right. Hello, everyone, and welcome to our second session on our Hyper-V and System Center operational training. We've got another good turnout here today. Today's session is going to continue on from where we left off yesterday, and it's likely, if I had to plan this out, this is going to be the second of around 8 sessions that are going to be required to, you know, operationalize yourself and your staff on either your existing Hyper-V projects and or your upcoming ones. Today's session, I'm lucky enough to actually have Clint be able to join us again today. So you've got myself, Dave Kula, and Clint Wyckoff. We're both what are called Cloud and Data Center Management MVPs for Microsoft. Clint is also a VMware vExpert. So if you guys have any questions, especially for the new customers that are on the line in regards to comparing Hyper-V and VMware, Clint is your guy. There's not really too much up that line of questions that he's not going to be able to help and answer for you guys. So like the other session, guys, quick little bit of housekeeping for you here. If you're not on Twitter, make sure you get on Twitter. You can follow myself at Dave Kula. You can follow Clint at Clint Wyckoff. Remember, we're typically very active in the Twitter and social media streams. And if we find new stuff that's coming out kind of surrounding Hyper-V and kind of ancillary technologies, we're going to typically be posting there first, so you want to make sure that you're following us, because we don't have time to be emailing everyone all the time. All right. So just a quick recap of yesterday's session before we get started here today. Yesterday we covered some of the core fundamentals of designing a Hyper-V infrastructure, what that was going to look like as you move forward into your data center. And kind of just walk through some very basic and some basic concepts around, you know, what was going to be required. Good feedback even for some of our senior Hyper-V administrators that were on the call yesterday. They said that they picked up a few new things, which is great. And as we go through this, I'm hoping that you guys will continue to be able to at least bridge the gap and, you know, fill some of the knowledge gaps that you'll have in a goal to help get you guys operationally sound. So the agenda for today's session that we have, and for most of the remaining sessions, are going to be a balance of demo and theory that we're going to be taking and going through. Most of the demos are going to be predicated on my standard builds that I've had for Hyper-V over the course of the past 6 to 8 years. I actually have customers on this call right now that we set up, helped them get set up on their initial Hyper-V 2008 farms, and have upgraded them all the way through. One of the things that I think that they can stand behind is that my builds are always extremely stable and extremely solid. So I'm very cautious and very meticulous when I build virtual environments. And as a result, you get a pretty good working product under the covers. So today's session, we're going to dig in a little bit more on the networking stack as it relates to Hyper-V. And there's a couple different ways that we can configure this. I'm a big fan of configuring it manually through PowerShell. I've done that for probably the last 8 years and been very successful with my customers on that. You can also configure it through System Center Virtual Machine Manager. That is a little bit more of an advanced configuration, and you really have to understand the underpinning and moving parts that you have in order to do that. So I always like to start with the foundational basics, and then if you want to extend and bridge that out and add some automation, you add the automation after the fact. You don't add the automation at the beginning, because then you won't understand how to troubleshoot and remediate issues as they come up. So Clint, before we jump in, anything that you want to add for today's session before we get started here?
No, I think we're ready to get to it.
Awesome. Okay, so the first thing that we have here is the actual physical wiring and connectivity that we have for our Hyper-V hosts and the different networks that are going to be required. So one of the ideas that I had for today's session, for those of you that are joining us, is we're going to bridge a kind of a live Hyper-V architecture. And we'll walk through what this configuration looks like from, you know, the theory of what needs to be configured, the network architecture design. So I've got a sample network architecture design for a customer that might have some Cisco Nexus infrastructure. It doesn't really change that much. It doesn't really matter what switches you have. It's the same general ideas and theory are going to play true across all of them. The one thing that has remained fairly consistent for Hyper-V 2012 R2 is the number of networks that are actually required. And we can call these networks VLANs. We can call them whatever you guys want. These are the actual architectural networks that are going to be required to build a proper Hyper-V infrastructure. So typically, I like to say normally there's a minimum of 3 to 4 that are required. Starting off with your management network, you want to have a dedicated VLAN for your cluster traffic. So that's your heartbeat traffic that's going to communicate inside of your cluster. You're going to want to segment off your live migration traffic. And for you VMware folks that are on the call, this is your vMotion network. You want to make sure that that's not going to be running on your front-facing network, so that, you know, you're going to have performance degradations and such. The other two that have started to become quite a bit more prevalent, well, the one that has is the replica network. Hyper-V supports out-of-box replication capabilities, so we want to typically segment and carve that off on a separate network. Not really required, but it's a good recommendation. And then, of course, having a storage network. Now, the storage network for me could be a variety of things. If your storage is connecting via fiber channel, then this would be, you know, your fiber channel host bus adapters or HBAs that are connected into your system. If this is an iSCSI design, then this would be a dedicated iSCSI network on a separate VLAN and maybe even connected into some different storage switches, depending on what your design looks like. And in today's build, I know that we're going to be having one of my customers that has recently purchased some gear from a company called Nutanix, and they build a hyper-converged solution. And so how they do it is they share out all the VMs over an SMB3 network. So basically what we talked about yesterday with going /// server name, share name to store all your virtual machines. And that's also a very popular design with Microsoft Consulting Services, where they have what's called the scale-out file server architecture sitting above Hyper-V, kind of just making what I like to call dumb hosts that just basically serve up compute and resources and don't have to worry about the underlying storage. So as we go and we build this out, a typical design, especially for the, I think I saw the folks from Teravita coming on the call here today, so welcome guys. So your design in particular, you're one of my customers that actually does use the Fibre Channel host bus adapters. And so those are a couple different ports that are connected in. And so those are going to take and be configured in that fashion. Now, there is another configuration option that you have, which is called an RDMA configuration. Clint, for the life of me, I can't remember the acronym for RDMA. I understand everything that it does, but
it's remote direct memory access.
Yeah, exactly. So with remote direct memory access, guys, there's actually a little bit of a bottleneck that happens in Hyper-V when you take and you configure things in Server 2012 R2, and I'm going to get into that in an upcoming slide here. But with an RDMA-enabled network adapter in Windows Server 2012 R2, there are no bottlenecks. So what people like to do is, if they were looking for maximum speed, for example, what they would do is they would take this RDMA NIC and they would actually use it for things like their live migration network, because then they could get maximum speed. These NICs here that are used typically to build our converged infrastructure inside of Hyper-V, these ones here are going to be a little bit rate limited, and I'll explain how that works and kind of what the reasoning and justification is for it. All right, so this RDMA NIC is kind of full speed, but there's a couple limitations with this. You can't actually team these adapters. These can only live as standalone adapters inside of Windows Server 2012 R2. In 2016, they've changed this now. You can actually team those adapters, which is really cool. But where you guys are at today, these are basically standalone single ports. So there's some limitations inside of that design. However, you can leverage the full speed of, you know, those particular networks. All right.
Yeah, and it's also only, you have to make sure that your network interface actually supports, you know, RDMA and is in fact an RDMA NIC. Right? So if that was something that you were trying to take advantage of, you would just need to make sure that you purchased that specific style of NIC ahead of time.
Exactly. All right. And so how this would typically carve out from an overall design perspective, and this is the way that I see most of our customers actually configuring things to a general extent, Clint, and to the listeners that are on the call here today. Let me just get my pen back here. So basically what we would do is in a typical Hyper-V design, and some of my customers are on gig infrastructure, and I would say that probably at least 90%+ right now are on 10 gig. So those customers that are on 10 gig, you have less ports to configure. So you could really get away with taking and having a limited number of ports. So for example, I've got some of my customers that we have 2 to 4 ports of 10 gig configured, whereas on my 1 gig customers, right now we're configuring between 4 to 6 ports inside of that team. So for some of you, this will just be basically plus the number of 1 gig adapters that we have that are set up inside of that teamed infrastructure. Pardon my drawing, everyone. I'm doing that actually with a mouse, so I'm actually pretty impressed with myself right now.
No, there's actually pretty good for a mouse.
There's no touch screen on this laptop I'm working on. So like most technologies you have, what we want to do is we want to bond these ports together, right? So we would take these physical network adapters that you'd see here, so NIC 1, NIC 2, up to however many NICs you have, and we want to aggregate those into a single channel. Now, from a Microsoft speak, what this looks like is we call that an LBFO team, and this is basically the terminology that Microsoft has for their Windows teams. So what this would look like, guys, is, and I want to actually just bounce over to my demo system here, just so that I can show you actually what this looks like as you go to construct and build this, because I find that these slides are helpful, but it's actually even a little bit more helpful if we can actually jump over to a live system. So I do have a live system that's ready to go. Clint, I'm just going to flip over to my other machine here. I'll make sure that my audience views
have
changed.
That looks good.
Perfect. All right, let me just minimize things here. All right. So what you guys are going to do is you're just going to open up Server Manager. And inside of Server Manager on a freshly configured Hyper-V host, you'll click on Local Server. And on Local Server, you'll come down to NIC Teaming. You'll notice how it's disabled on all your Windows servers by default. Simply just click that button. And by the way, you can configure all of this with PowerShell. So I'm just showing you the GUI UI. I can see already I have an issue with one of my adapters in here, Clint, that I'm only showing a 100 meg connection instead of a 1 gig connection. Unfortunately for my lab, I don't have 10 gig switches. So I'm just connecting this into gig, and I can tell I've got some type of cabling issue there because I don't have any 100 meg switches. So what I want to do here is I want to actually stand up that Windows team. It's super easy, guys. You just click on Tasks under Teams, create a new team. I normally create these teams with a name called Prod Team. And when you take and you type in Prod Team, this is going to be the name of the teamed adapter that will take and will show up in here. So when I look at my network connections, I can see that I've only got two Ethernet connections in here, Ethernet and Ethernet 2. And as soon as I go to create this, I'll just simply select one of the adapters. And then this teamed adapter, virtual adapter, will actually show up inside of my network control panel. So when we take and we come through here, there's a couple different teaming modes that we have, and we'll get to these a little bit later. And it's a mixed bag that I have for my customers today. Some use switch independence, and some are going to use link aggregation control protocol, or LACP. So this is just a pop quiz for everybody. Which one of these two modes is going to require some switch configuration? So if you guys want, you can just go ahead and type your answers while I'm going in the chat window, because one of these does indeed require a switch configuration and one does not. Probably one of the most popular configurations, Clint, that I have seen for Hyper-V servers is switch independent. And the reason is you don't actually have to go interface at that level with the switches to do your configurations. The problem with this is, though, is that all of the task offloading and load balancing happens at your Windows server and your Hyper-V host level. So you do take a little bit of a performance hit on there. It's marginal, but there is a little bit of performance hit. And if we've got a strong networking team, sometimes they'll want to own those configurations. So I probably got about a 50-50 mix right now of customers running LACP versus switch independent. Those of you that are running on your Nutanix infrastructure today, Nutanix's built-in scripts that they configure through their Prism infrastructure actually use switch independent teaming. So that's all built in by default. I don't want to configure my switches with LACP right now because I haven't pre-configured my switch port, so I'll just leave it as switch independent. I'll go ahead and I'll click OK. And what we'll see is there'll be a fault in here, and this is quite normal, just as it actually goes to negotiate and stand up and build the team for us. If I come back to my networking control panel, I can see that I've got prod team in here. And one of the things to note is that if I go to the adapter that we added as part of that team, you'll notice how all of the TCP/IP and networking properties have been switched off. And now the only thing that's left on there is something called the Microsoft Network Adapter Multiplexer Protocol. Go ahead and try to say that 10 times in a row. That's a bit of a tongue twister. So the Multiplexer Protocol is actually the teaming drivers that Windows uses. And you'll see this inside of Hyper-V as we get to this in just a moment. And if I come back
so
over
Dave,
to
can I ask you a question real quick here?
Yeah, go ahead.
One of the things that we typically get asked about this, you know, is what are the benefits of using the native Windows teaming versus, say, for instance, if I had Broadcom NICs and using their software suite for teaming?
Oh, it's an absolutely fantastic question, because we were stuck in a world back in 2008 before Microsoft had these multiplexer drivers that we had to use the vendor teaming drivers. And funny enough that you asked that question, Clint, because I actually just had a client that we were working with. It was probably about a month and a half ago. And I looked at their system, and they were actually using the Intel teaming drivers instead of the default teaming drivers. The big difference here is you can't phone Microsoft for the vendor teaming drivers. So if you're on a Premier support contract or you're doing a pay-as-you-go support contract, no way, baby, you can't phone Microsoft for support on this. So you have to make sure that you use those built-in teaming drivers inside of Windows, and that is the new norm. So if you're doing it the old way, we got to get you to stop doing that, and you got to start using the Windows teaming. And that's going to be the same moving forward for 2016, all the way starting from 2012. All right. So that is our first representation of this slide that we were looking at here. So this LBFO team, this right here is what we just created. So this, we gave a name in here, and I think we called this thing prod team, right? So we called this guy prod team. I don't want to write out all this, but I am. So this is prod team. So this is what you guys actually saw inside of the UI when we went through and configured this. So now both of those ports, however many we have, are now bonded together, and they're part of that that team. Now, before we continue on and we want to go through the rest of the switch configuration, what mode did we use again there, Clint? Did we use switch independence, or did we use link aggregation control protocol?
I believe you left it on switch independent.
That's right. So we actually didn't require any switch configurations there, right? So what do you think is going to happen, Clint, if I come back in here and I edit this team's properties, and I come down to additional properties, and I change this to link aggregation control protocol, bearing in mind that I have not configured my switches? Now,
it's going to break and it's not going to work?
Kind of, because some switches that are out there are actually smart enough that they can actually kind of build an Ether channel pairing on the fly. I don't really recommend that. Like, some models of HP switches I've seen will do this, because they'll just dynamically pair together. It sees that LACP traffic is actually coming through, and it'll just do that. So if I go ahead and
I know specifically
here
on Cisco gear, at least on some of the Nexus things that I have experience with, you definitely have to build the virtual port channel and have that configured on the switch side before you can even make any sort of changes on the client side. I mean, for it to work, right? It has to match.
For sure. So if we take a look here, I'm just going to see if I can actually get my pen here. See if I can circle this. Perfect. So do you guys see how that is saying faulted LACP negotiation? So what exactly does this mean for us? This means that we forgot to do our backend switch configuration. And this is actually a little bit of a problem for me, Clint, when I go to deal with automating server builds, because I do a lot of work with zero-touch based installations. And this is something that we have to now integrate and talk to the network team. So at this point in time, I would have to go to the networking team and say, hey, guys, I'm ready for you. Can you take in, can you stand up my Ether channel bond? So Ether channel is the Cisco terminology or nomenclature for actually building the backend components. And guys, it's a little different with each switch manufacturer. So Juniper does it slightly differently. Dell, HP, they're all slightly different. Same general concepts, because these are all IEEE standards that we have that are out there. And they're all RFC compliant. So you can see that that's actually broken right now, right? So let me just go ahead and get rid of my drawings there. Let's go fix our problem. And guys, I'm going to do a lot of this stuff on purpose with breaking these things so that you guys can actually see what these changes in the UI are going to look like. Because otherwise, you're going to see this in an operational fashion, and you're not going to really know what's going on. So the next thing that I want to show everybody here is, let's actually take a look and see what the Cisco switch config will look like. So I've got a lot of different customers on the line here. Some I have configured the network architectures and designs for already, and some I have not. And for those of you that we haven't configured your network architecture design documents for Hyper-V, if you guys could just chime in here with a yes or no in the chat window, we will help you build these. So this is one of the deliverables that I always give to all of the clients that we work with, is a network architecture design for Hyper-V. And we've got pretty much most of the mainstream switches and their configurations that are required right now. So from HP Flex Fabric to most common model Cisco switches to Junipers. I think the only ones that we're a little light on is some Dell switches right now, but we kind of hit those as we go through project by project. And so what we do is we map out just a simple network architecture inside of this document for you. And this document is going to show the kind of switch design that you have. Now, the typical design that we had seen in the past was to take and to configure the switches in this type of a fashion, where we might have what is called a dual core configuration, okay? So dual core configuration means that these two switches right here, they're going to actually operate independently of one another, and then they're going to communicate, and then they're going to share a configuration. The new norm that we're seeing, because the new switches that are out on the market today can have shared power supplies and shared, so it's kind of shared backplanes, we find that a lot of customers, from simplicity standpoint, what they'll do is they'll simply just stack these switches. And then these switches will actually just become kind of one virtual switch with multiple ports. So if there's 48 ports in each of these switches, we would just simply see one 96 port virtual switch entity that's created as you stack those together. It makes the configurations a little more simple. So we have the designs for dual core, and we have the designs from a stacked configuration. The stacked configuration, from my perspective, is probably the easiest one to take and manage and support, just because there's a lot less moving parts to support under the covers. So when you take and you build this out, typically what we have to do is we have to build out those VLANs that we were talking about there, Clint. So we're going to have a VLAN for management, a VLAN for cluster shared migration traffic and heartbeat traffic. We're going to have a VLAN for live migration and a VLAN for backup replication or storage or whatever else was required. This was just a sample design. So our storage VLAN here was like VLAN 4, for example. If this is fiber channel, it's not really required. So as I take and go through here, one of the big questions that I always get, and this is coming from my Windows Server administrators, they actually have no idea what the heck Ether channel is. It's just some kind of magical stuff that happens on the back-end switches, and I need to talk to my network guy, and it's broken, and he goes and he fixes something for me, and all of a sudden my ports light up. So what I wanted to share with everybody is what those back-end switch configurations actually look like, so that you can kind of fill that gap a little bit, okay? So if we take a look here, it's got some kind of stuff in here. This is just kind of a wiring uplink. And by the way, everybody, I will share the document with you. Normally we'll take and we'll kind of customize it for each of your environments. We like to do the port wiring diagram, so for whatever you've got configured. So if you ever, heaven forbid, have to move your data centers, at least you can see what's plugged into what. Takes us normally about 4 hours to redo one of these documents on a customer-by-customer basis. The base kind of raw switch configuration here. Hopefully everybody can see that okay. I'm just going to zoom this in a little bit. Clint, is that better zoomed in there? All right, so what I'm going to do is, this is just some basic switch configuration stuff, guys, where we're just creating those individual VLANs, assigning IP addresses to them, and there's a section down here called an Ether channel configuration, and that's where we would have to take and we would have to create those settings on the Cisco switch. So what you'd do is you'd log into the switch, you'd take and you'd enable LACP, and then what you have to do is these groups are called port channels, okay? So it's also known as Ether channel, depending on who you're working with, okay? So we create these port channel groups, and then what we have to do is, this is the kind of virtual name that we would have for that particular LACP group or pairing. And so what we would have to do is say, okay, this port channel is going to be running on this default VLAN, which would be VLAN 10, It's also going to be allowed to run VLANs 8 through 29, 50, 60, 98 through 103. So those VLANs are going to be allowed to run through there. We're going to set it up as a trunk mode so that we can actually take and pass through that traffic. And this is important because if these are virtual machines, those virtual machines could be running on different networks as well. All right. And then after we're done with the port channel configurations, then we have to actually assign the physical interfaces to those particular particular port channels. So for example, I've got a physical interface on the switch that's on switch 1, port 17. I want to take and I want to bind this into this particular port channel group, okay? And so this is basically when we're working with our network guys, this is basically what they have to run on a port by port basis in order to get those LACP settings on our actual servers to light up. So this is templatable. It's fairly easy to do, but there is a bit of work for the networking guys behind the scenes. So the big difference between this and switch independent mode teaming is the fact that on switch independent mode teaming, I would basically just have to set these trunk settings. That's it. I don't have to actually set the channel groups in behind. And there's an interesting theory that I've been working with and talking to some hosters about, Clint, and that is, why are we actually restricting all of these VLANs on a switch basis? So I understand from a security standpoint, but when you're a hoster and you're trying to build this as a larger private cloud as a shared service, do you ever really want to have to worry about touching that switch again? So, you know, what you could do is you could do something like this, Clint, is you could say, I want to do switch port allow from 1 to 5,000. And then anything that's inside of that range is just going to work. So what I've found some of these hosters have done is they've just pre-configured their environments and lit up all the VLANs. And then what they're doing is they're allowing what's called the software-defined data center, so allowing Windows or VMware or whatever to make the decisions as to what VLANs to actually pass through. The beauty in doing that inside of your designs, guys, is that it's a one-time configuration on your switch. Now, old school thought that's maybe a good idea or not good idea, but with the fact of the matter is that we're stretched super thin from a resource perspective at most of your organizations, this makes your design super, super easy, okay? So when you take and you build this out, what's going to end up happening is that you would basically configure all of those switch ports that are wired in as a one-time operation, and then you can configure to your heart's content inside of Windows. Does that make sense? We can just pause here. Like, I don't know if anybody's got any questions here. That's kind of a long kind of spiel from me. Guys, I spend a little bit of extra time going through the networking configuration. And Clint, you can probably agree with me on this because most of the problems that we see for customers in the field is because there's a lack of knowledge around how their back-end network infrastructure is actually plugged into their virtual hosts. Would you agree with that, Clint? I think I put Clint to sleep. Clint, are you there? Are you on mute? I think I did a really good job, guys. I think I put Clint to sleep. Can you guys actually hear me okay? I wasn't just talking to dead air, was I? I hope you guys can hear me.
Yes.
Okay, perfect. I'm glad because I think Clint actually fell asleep on his keyboard. All right.
I had to step out for a second.
No problem. Did he actually say that? No. I suppose if I kept up with all of the chat, then I could actually see all of this stuff. Just give me a sec. Perfect. Oh, yeah, okay, got it. Okay, so the next piece that we're going to take and that we're going to go through here, guys, is after we have this this team configured, so whether or not it's in switch independent mode or LACP, then what we're going to do is we're going to actually take it, we're going to have to create something that Hyper-V can use, because right now this team is good to go for Windows. So if I take and I come back over to my host over here, and if I try to get out and online on the internet, I'm good to go. I can ping, I can get out on the internet, and that's all running through that teamed adapter in switch independent mode, which is cool, right? But now what we have to do is start looking at our first Hyper-V component. So if I open up Hyper-V Manager, and I do apologize, guys. I know some of you are still running on server 2012 R2. This is a 2016 server. They look pretty close to identical, though. And so if there's a new button or something that's in there, that's going to be why. But from a Hyper-V Manager standpoint, they're going to be pretty close. So now what we have to do is, in a similar fashion to what happens in VMware, we have to create external switches and switches that can talk to the outside network. And so that type of port profiling and those switch creations can be done manually in here through the Virtual Switch Manager. So if I click inside of my Virtual Switch Manager, yesterday we talked about the fact that there was three different types of virtual switches that we can have. And so the first one that we'll start with is we'll start with a private vSwitch here, okay? So if we have ourselves a Hyper-V host, so we have ourselves a Hyper-V host machine here, and then this Hyper-V host machine is going to be taking, it's going to be running a couple of virtual machines off of it. So we'll have a VM number one, and we'll have a VM number two. What private allows is private allows these two virtual machines to talk to one another, and they are not allowed. They're completely fenced off and isolated from anything on the physical network. So if this is our actual switch up here, and this guy's wired in here, they're fenced off. That traffic can never leave. And that particular virtual switch name that they're connected to, you can think that it looks like this, something in a logical representation, that they have a private switch here. And anything that's connected to this private switch with this name is allowed to communicate. And you can have as many of those private virtual switches as you want. There's no real limitation. But it's a way, great way for like lab and kind of fencing that environment off. Now, the only difference with the internal switch here, guys, is the internal switch. If this is actually set up as an internal switch, think of it as actually being on this side, and we can actually have traffic flow going outbound, but the traffic flow stops at our host. You cannot step off of your host. This is great in the old school days for copying files in and out of my VMs from my host. Typically now we can do some copy to functions in 2016 with PowerShell Direct and some of those new things. And then the external virtual switch here, this is going to basically allow traffic flow all the way out to the corporate network. Okay. And so when we take and we build and we configure this, we can take this and we can stand this up. And let's say we wanted to build an external virtual switch so that we could take and allow traffic through. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to show you this inside of the UI first, and then what I'll do is I'll show you this inside of PowerShell, because there's a couple of reasons why we build these out in PowerShell, because there's certain features that that we can't configure in here, and I'll show you what some of those are. So if I call this virtual switch VSW01, I can go ahead and I can select which adapter we want. So if we go back to our networking control panel, we have adapter 1, adapter 2, and adapter 3. Funny enough, though, these names don't really look the same, do they? So when I take a look in here, these names actually don't correlate to what we see here. Okay? What you're looking at is you're looking at this descriptive name has always been this guy right here, not this guy. So not your Ethernet 2. Not your Ethernet, not your prod team. To see how this guy's called the Microsoft Network Adapter Multiplexer Driver, blah, blah, blah. Watch what happens when I hit the pull down here. So if I hit this pull down, let me just wipe my drawings. To see how it's the adapter protocol. So the only way for you to actually tell what's going on from a Hyper-V perspective in building this manually is if I change my view around so that I can actually see what's what. Yeah, little bit of a pet peeve for me with Microsoft for years, but this is where they're actually pulling those settings from, okay? And so now another setting in here is allow management operating system through this adapter. So this is what we call the management adapter. And so if I leave this checked off, what's going to end up happening when this switch gets built is I'm actually going to see a virtual adapter that gets created in here for the virtual switch. And these IP settings will move across. Now, if I don't do that, what ends up happening is it'll actually look like nothing has happened. The virtual switch will be there, but we can't actually see it in the networking configuration, okay? So we'll do this twice. I'll do this once with this checked off and once with it not checked off, just so that you guys can see what's going on. So if I go ahead and I hit apply, this is just going to take a second. So that prod team went down, so we can see what's going on here. And then in a second, we'll see my VSW01 virtual adapter actually show up in here. Oh, why did that fail on me? Oh, help if I actually chose the right adapter, huh? Let's try that. All right. So you can see that now I've got prod team, I've got vEthernet, and then I've got vEthernet VSW01. Okay, so guys, as we go through this training, I'm going to point out some things that are really important for you from an operational standpoint. First thing that's really important for you from an operational standpoint, never create a virtual switch with this enabled, okay? The reason for that is this actually creates a really weird name in PowerShell for this switch that's hard for me to modify after the fact. So if I open up PowerShell and I went to go get my my network adapters, this is actually going to show a really funny name and description on it. So what I'm going to do is I'm just going to show you what this looks like in PowerShell. So I'll just open up my PowerShell prompt here. You can show these in PowerShell by just going get netadapter. And if you guys want a little trick for running PowerShell commands in the IFE, if you hit F9, it'll highlight the whole line, and then you can hit F8 and it'll run that actual line. So I ran this command, get netadapter sort name, with pipe sort name, and it returned all three of my adapters that you saw in there originally. Now, if I run this again, watch the difference here. Do you see how the name of this adapter is vEthernet, and then it has like parentheses, open brackets, VSW01 here? So if we can see this. So that name is actually not the same as when I go ahead and I create my virtual adapters with this script. So if I went to go at this point in time and bind and add an additional virtual adapter for, let's say, my management network or something that I was building and standing up for my converged infrastructure, the name is actually different. So if I come down here, and I want to just highlight this to you guys, to see when I build this in PowerShell, what am I setting here? Am I setting that to allow management OS on or on management OS off? And I actually discovered this probably about 6 months or so ago, and it started to become a problem as I was trying to do some more scripting inside. So some of you that had probably early versions of my script, I actually did leave that on, and I've kind of changed my guidance a little bit now, okay? So if I come down and you see where it says add VM network adapter, management OS name, live migration VLAN 5, this is going to be a way more descriptive and easy to use name, because I can actually call this name inside a PowerShell later on, and I don't have to type in this vEthernet VSW01. So when you let it just manually create that, it puts a weird name in there, and it's hard to modify that from a PowerShell perspective. Okay, so I just wanted to point that out, and I wanted to show you actually why I'm actually not checking off that checkbox. Okay. So when we take and we get back here, and let's actually tear down that switch so we can just now remove that switch. Now, the only way to remove a switch, by the way, from an operational standpoint, is for you to take and not have any virtual machines attached to this. So if you had VMs created and they were binding through this particular virtual switch, then you can't actually remove this until you remove all of those adapters. And there's a quick PowerShell command that we can take and run to rip all those adapters out if we wanted to tear this out after the fact. So now you can see I'm back to that kind of original configuration, right, guys? And so inside of this original configuration, we come back into Hyper-V Manager, come back into Virtual Switch Manager, create external virtual switch. We're just going to call this VSW01. any of my customers that are out there, it's typically VSW 01 or 02. Those are the typical names I'll use. And this time I'll not check off that checkbox. And so I want you to see the difference here. Now, at this point in time, this particular host, if I actually did this live and I had a team set up, I would actually lose connectivity. Because check this out down here. Do you guys see an additional adapter in here? Where's the actual switch? Where did my IP address go? So if I take a look in here at this particular adapter, okay, so this adapter is part of the team. Okay, so I get that. So this adapter here is going to be part of the team. And then the team is part of the virtual switch, which just went where? Exactly. So what has to happen here is that we actually have to create a management virtual adapter now manually. And I'm fine with that. I don't mind building that management virtual adapter manually because I'm in full control of how that gets built. I don't want that funky name in there. So it's more of a like cosmetic housekeeping thing for me as I script into this later on. So that's why I actually disabled that. But if I had bound both of these cards to that team right now, I would actually have no connectivity. I would have to go in through ILO or DRAC or something to get back into the box, which is probably not very good. So let's go ahead and let's actually stand this up. So before we do that, does anybody have any questions? I'm just going to take a moment to just kind of review what we have in the chat here. And hopefully this is making sense to everybody.
Hey, sorry about that. I had to step away for a minute, but I'm back now.
Yeah, no problem. And I was just going back through the chat, and it looks like the guys over at Affinity, Zach and the team, are using LACP. Chad over at Yavapai, you guys are using LACP. I've got a couple that are using Switch Independent. Perfect. Thanks, guys. So now, as we take and we move back to this, I'll show you what the actual configuration script looks like. So if you run your PowerShell script now, what will it look like? Great.
PowerShell script.
Great question. I'm getting a bit of an echo from you there again, Clint, for some reason. Okay, so let's go ahead and let's do that. Let's stand up this infrastructure. So let me just come back here, guys. I'm just going to come back here. So now what we're going to do is we're going to actually build this out. So we're going to build out our management NICs. We're going to build out our cluster NICs. We're going to build out our live migration NICs and anything that's defined inside of that script. And then that script is actually going to go ahead and configure this in the appropriate VLANs, okay? So this will be on like VLAN 1, VLAN 5, VLAN 6. So the guys at Terabita, I actually grabbed the same script that we used for you guys last week, so it should look fairly familiar for you. So let's just go ahead and stand that up now, because then we can actually see what it does. And guys, the reason that I teach this way is because I find it's very, very helpful to actually see the moving parts in progress as they go. So we do have it. So we do have a team that's created prod team. So that's important because that's the name that we define inside the script. I just have to go turf this switch here because we're going to go ahead and create the switch. And what I'm going to do is I'm just going to go line by line through the actual script. I'm not going to run it all at once. So if we rerun this line here, we can see that I'm down to my three adapters. Okay. Remember, you're just going to press F9 on your lines and then F8 to run them. So the only thing here is I have to reference an adapter called prod team. So I do have an adapter, so this will work. So I go ahead and I run this. And as soon as I run that, the adapters look like they disappear and reappear for a second, and they'll come online in a second here. And then if we take a look, we can see that I've got VSW01 created. So before we continue, I just want to show you what that looks like after it's created in PowerShell, guys. So if I click on VSW01 now, we can see that some of the settings in here are going to be grayed out. And so the reason some of the settings are grayed out is because of the fact that it's created in PowerShell. That's perfectly normal, okay? So go ahead and click cancel. So we've got a virtual switch created, VSW01. Now let's go ahead, and if I followed my own instructions, F9, F8. Now we can see that we still have only those three adapters created, right? Because I didn't choose to create the management adapter. And now we'll create our first adapter. So the first one that we're going to create is actually going to be, actually we can create all of these at the same time. So I'll go ahead here. I'm just going to get this teed up. There we go. And watch this. So those three adapters will pop into there. Now I want to show you what this looks like from this perspective. So see how it says vEthernet management VLAN 1 instead of VSW? It doesn't have the switch name. It actually has my virtual adapter name, right? So that's a little bit easier for me to manage. And if I come back to here and I rerun the sorting, I can see that the VSW01 isn't included because that VSW01, that switch name, actually gets embedded in there and you can't rename that. So that's my actual technical reason why I don't like to do that, okay? All right, so the next thing that we have to do is we have to set some quality of service settings inside of here. So this is the quality of service settings. When you take and you define these guys, the values are up to a total of 100, okay? And so what you can do in here is you can carve out some of the different bandwidth that you have on a per virtual adapter basis. And I'll show you what this looks like inside of PowerShell before we configure this. And I'm going to get into another quick little piece about how the network stack actually works in here. So if I go get-vm network adapter-management-os, those virtual adapters here, if you want to take and if you want to look at them inside of PowerShell, you have to use this management-os to look at these objects down here, because otherwise the get-vm network adapter just looks at the network adapters that are inside of your guests in Hyper-V, okay? So that's what the dash management OS is going to be used for in there. And once that's done, then what we can do is we can take a look at going through and just seeing what those look like. So we just press enter, and this will dump everything out, okay? So I'm going to show you a little trick. If you do a format list, this will actually open up all the property sheets on all of these adapters. And so when I take a look at this, do you see how my bandwidth percentage here is actually undefined right now? So bandwidth percentage here is 0. The other ones are probably going to be sitting in 0 as well. Let's scroll up here. Go up to the next adapter, 0000000. Okay, that's following so far because we haven't set and defined that yet. Okay, now this is where things get a little bit interesting for us. So let's go ahead and let's just run this. So go run that. Thank you very much. Now we'll go press the up arrow again. And now, what's my bandwidth percentage at, guys? Oh, bandwidth percentage, 49%. That looks pretty close, doesn't it? Right? Does that make sense? The more you carve these out, the more that these actually get shared from a weighting perspective. Because what you're actually defining here is you're defining this weighting value, which is 50% of the available bandwidth, which is 49% at this point in time. It's easy enough to figure out because we've only got three adapters. Some of my customers I've seen have like 7, 8, 9, 10 virtual adapters. The more you carve that up, the less this percentage is going to be overall. Now, a little tidbit for you, something that I had discovered is that when I had this configuration, this converged configuration, I figured, okay, well, I have a Hyper-V host machine here, okay? This Hyper-V host machine has its teamed adapters that are created here, and I've got a couple of 10 gig trunks that are taking and coming out of here. So I got a couple of 10 gig trunks that are coming out. And I want this guy to actually be able to just go copy files across the network. He's going to copy those over to another Hyper-V host. This Hyper-V host has exactly the same script run on it. It's identical. It has all the virtual adapters. Basically, I just want to copy from vEthernet on VLAN 5 to vEthernet on VLAN 5 on the other side. I want to just copy a file. I want to take a file from here to here. Now, based on those weighting thresholds that we would have, if that was a 10 gig network, I had kind of figured that I would be getting, you know, a full 5 gigs because I've got 50%, right? It's actually not true, guys. In 2012 R2, the converged adapters that you see inside of here are actually rate limited. These adapters here are rate limited to a maximum of 3 to 5 gigabit. You'll never hit a full 10. you will never, ever hit a full 10 on that, no matter what you do, okay? And the reason for that is, if you take a look inside of Device Manager, in Device Manager, you'll see all your cores that you'll have. Or I suppose I can just pull up Task Manager here. So we'll go here, let's pull up Task Manager. And inside of Task Manager, I can see all of my CPUs in here, right? So I go to Performance, I see this, I want to change graph to all my logical processors. And what you have to think of is this, is that depending on the speed of your processor that you have, is going to actually depend on how fast you can go upwards of that 3 to 5 gigabit. The reason is, someone, for their infinite wisdom at Microsoft, actually coded the network stack for the converged adapters to run here. They don't run here. They don't run here. They don't run here. They don't run here. They run here. Single core. See where there's a little bit of a bottleneck there? All right. And so this is the reason that you're a little rate limited. Now, that 3 to 5 gigabit limit has actually been changed in Windows Server 2016. It's now been changed to, I think the number is something like 56 gigabit now.
Right.
And so that's a big change. So Clint and I have done extensive speed testing on this. And I pulled my hair out for probably 2 weeks. And for those of you that are my existing customers or my older customers that we had set this up on, I actually didn't even know about this myself until about, I think it was February of this year, that we actually discovered this particular issue in the fact that those are rate limited. And it's a big bottleneck, because what that means is that if I have this live migration network, is this live migration network ever going to be able to go from host to host at 10 gig? Never, ever, ever. So that's why how people worked around this a little bit. What they would do is, if they had some additional 10 gig ports in here, let's say they had another 10 gig port, what they would do is they could even team those together as a separate team. So instead of prod team, maybe this was like a live migration team over here. And they didn't turn on any of the Hyper-V networking components, any of the converged infrastructure. And then they set that up to go host to host. Then they could get their full 10 gig. And where this gets worse, guys, is if, forget about live migration, what if this is actually your storage network? What if you have to access your SAN over the network? iSCSI, SMB3, whatever it is. Your storage network now, if you had your storage network inside of here as a virtual adapter, that's rate limited to 3 to 5 gigs. You're never going to get full speed over there. And I want to get full speed over here because that's where I actually need full speed. So a lot of VDI deployments and stuff like that would start to fall down because people didn't understand that there was actually this rate limitation. The fix for it is quite simple. You just have to add a couple adapters. But the thought of adding a couple adapters in a large farm, especially in 10 gig infrastructure, I could be, you know, if you had 16 hosts in your data center and you wanted to add an additional 2 10 gig ports to each of them, you're talking about 30, you're burning 32 10 gig ports. Those aren't cheap, right? Just to fix this problem. So if you're looking for some justification,
your servers even have open slots.
Exactly. So if you're looking for a justification to go to this guy here, Server 2016, now you have it, because this is just a non-issue and we can actually get away with a two-port configuration in Server 2016. So I'm sorry to kind of digress and kind of wind down the rabbit hole there a little bit, but this is really important for you guys to understand with, if you ever run into stress testing, performance issues, anything like that when it comes to Hyper-V, and good luck finding any documentation on this anywhere, guys, because it doesn't exist. Microsoft didn't publish this. We got this internally from the product teams, and I had to pull teeth to actually get them to send me an email with these actual numbers to tell me exactly what these were between 3 to 5 gig and the 56 gig. So, all right. So does that make a little bit more sense? So if I come back to this slide now again, now what we've done is we've created our virtual switch. Our virtual switch that we've created here is called VSW01, right? And we can attach virtual machines to this, no problem. And then the virtual adapters that we just created these guys here. So these virtual adapters are the ones that you saw, and you can create as many of those as you want. Just understand what those configurations are actually going to look like, okay? All right. Let me just wipe my slide drawings here. I think I want to... Just give me one sec here, guys. If I advance that, is that going to stay on? Yep. I might get rid of that. There we go. Erase all ink. Okay. So now the next piece here is, guys, we talked about the actual teaming mode. So remember that dynamic is automatic. So we learned about that yesterday, that the dynamic LBFO team methods are there. And I think I have a little more information on that today, actually. And by the way, guys, if you have any questions at all from like regarding this network configuration or anything like that, you guys just fire away with anything you got. I know it can be a little bit to take in there. All right. Hopefully you guys like the style of doing this with a little bit of live. You guys like the little bit of live demo better than just taking and being PowerPointed to death? Because I know I hate being PowerPointed to death.
I like PowerPoint better.
I like PowerPoint better too. So Chad had a question in here, which was actually really good. And the question was, why is the bandwidth percentage 50% instead of 49%? Because it's the weighting that was set at 50%, and you have three adapters in there that are sharing across that, and that's just the way that it figures out the algorithm. And did you see my question about NIC updates?
Where is up here, whenever I update NIC drivers, it destroys the virtual NICs and I have to do it all over again. Anyone else have this issue?
Yes, sir. So Carl has been lucky enough to find out something rather nasty with Hyper-V, Server 2012 R2, and I haven't tested this in 2016. And I think that if we take a look at this drawing that you guys are seeing right now, basically what Carl is saying, I have these NICs, these physical adapters, and I want to go from, I think Carl, you're using Intel, right? So you're on like an Intel, let's say you're on 20.1 or something like that. And Intel says, oh my goodness, I just had big time issues with 20.1. Everybody in the world should go to 21.2 or some later version. And the short answer is, Carl, yes, I have absolutely experienced this. So what will happen sometimes when you go to update these drivers is it actually destroys these guys. And it takes and it says, oh, you know what? This guy here, this NIC here, used to have a name called what? Something like Ethernet 1, right? And when I go to take the new drivers on this guy, his name actually changes. His name is now ETH4. And because he's got a brand new name, what was the LBFO and multiplexer driver bound to? He was actually bound to Ethernet 1. So it destroys that component. And then it destroys this component. And it'll actually tear out a bunch of that stuff on you. So you need to be extremely careful and make sure that you do testing of those driver updates before you put them in, because yes, Carl, I have seen those tear things out as well. And it's a very good point. So you want me to do that right now? No, I don't think so, Chad. I don't think we'll do that right now, because then I don't think that I will have a very good demo environment. All right. All right, that was just a discussion around RDMA. We chatted about that. Some of the different switch types that we have inside of here. So this is just the actual PowerShell commandlets that you guys can use for taking and creating some of those. All right. Here's a good one. When you create a virtual switch type, virtual adapter inside of the VM, there's two types, right, Clint? Did you want to just quickly explain to everyone what the difference is between the legacy and the synthetic adapters? What is the difference there?
That's a really good question, but I don't know the answer to off the top of my head.
Okay. So the legacy adapters in 2012 R2, if you're using a generation one virtual machine, these ones here will allow you to Pixie boot. And if you're on a Gen 2 VM, then these guys here will allow you to Pixie boot. Okay. So that's number one. Number two is this guy has a maximum speed of this. And this guy here has a maximum speed of this. Right? So he's 10 gig. And he's 100 meg. Now, that last drawing that I showed you guys on the communication between host to host, where it's rate limited, 3 to 5 gigs, I want to just clarify something. The reason that this never hit mainstream is that when you have a VM to VM, so let's say that you've got a Hyper-V host, and underneath you have a virtual machine that's running, it has an adapter that's added inside of there, so it has a VNIC inside of here. This VNIC runs at full speed. There's no rate limiting on the actual VMs themselves. The only rate limiting is off the virtual adapters, off the hosts themselves. So if this VM wanted to talk to another VM on that host, he's going to get full speed, okay? And if he wants to go communicate over the network, he's going to get good speed. Where you're not going to get good speed is when you come through those virtual adapters. Okay, so I just wanted to quickly clarify that. So typically, guys, when you build your virtual machines, make sure that you're probably 99% of the time using synthetic network adapters. There's two choices on the pull-downs that you have. So you see network adapter here, it has legacy network adapter. Don't use this guy. There's really no good reason in today's day and age that you're probably going to be using this guy, okay? And delete my drawings. Erase my pen. Kind of going pen crazy today, Clint. All right, so non-converged infrastructure. So let's say that you guys weren't really happy about the 3 to 5 gigabit discussion for the converged infrastructure and you wanted to do this the good old-fashioned way. Can you do it? Yeah, you can, but the problem that you have is you're burning a whole bunch of extra ports and you're doing all your configurations manually. So not really a good way to do this. You can still run your Hyper-V servers like that, but I don't really see anybody doing this anymore. If you were doing non-converged, you can actually configure QoS policies on those non-converged adapters. So if you're dealing with physical servers that you want to just create some different policies on, some QoS policies, like the waiting settings that we had, you can still actually do that on physical adapters. This doesn't work on the converged. This only works on the actual non-converged adapters, but it is possible to do it. Okay. And Hyper-V converged infrastructure is good. So this is what you're seeing in that representation where we have the converged stack here and we've got all of our different virtual adapters connecting to our virtual switch VSW01. Coming through this way. And then an optional RDMA configuration, which is kind of, yeah, it depends on what you've got for actual adapters that are going to support that. All right. This was a nice little nugget. I did the demo for you guys already. So the nice little nugget is that for our networking guys or people that are interested, all Hyper-V virtual switches are set to trunk all by default. So do you guys remember when I said that on your switches, maybe you should consider setting them to trunk all? Well, Microsoft has already done this for you. So those virtual switches, when you create them, are set to trunk all by default. There's no limitations on them. That way the SDN, software-defined networking stack, can kick in. And you don't actually have to worry about it. All right. Erase. Next. And I think this was just the actual, some advanced configurations that we can actually take a look at going through here. So do you guys remember, when I told you that you can take a look at having advanced configurations once you learn the underpinnings of your hypervisor, once you learn the underpinnings of how this stuff actually bolts together. So let's say, for example, we're running Hyper-V for a little while and we're cool. We want to actually not have to worry about running Dave's manual PowerShell script. We want to let Virtual Machine Manager do all the work for us. Virtual Machine Manager in like System Center Virtual Machine Manager can do all of that stuff for you and then some. It's just, I like to teach you guys the manual way first, because then when I go to show you this stuff, it's like, oh, it's just, this is the console doing all of that stuff behind the scenes for us. So remember yesterday we talked about a concept that we had for isolating some of the networks. So we can do that inside of VMM. We can have logical segmentations of networks, and you can define these inside of Virtual Machine Manager. So this is kind of handy, especially if you're dealing with larger environments with a lot of VMs crossing a lot of different VLANs or a lot of different business units and stuff like that. So that's kind of handy to be able to do that inside of VMM. And what we're going to do as part of one of the later sessions that we're going to do is we're going to actually show you guys how to do this stuff in VMM as well. So I've just got some slides that kind of explain, because I know some of you are looking at VMM saying, well, why do I need VMM? You know, that question always comes up. So Clint, do you think that that's a fair question that we often see, is that, well, I don't really need VMM. What does VMM give me that these other tools don't? Why do I have four different tools to manage Hyper-V?
That's a really good question. So, you know, I think the first kind of primary use case of VMM is consolidating management of all your, you know, if you have multiple Hyper-V nodes in a cluster, right, or even multiple clusters, you can consolidate those multiple offices, you can consolidate the management of everything and all those into kind of that single, I hate to use the kind of buzzword, but the single pane of glass view. But it really goes a little bit further than that, as you said, right? So you can, automate your network configurations. You can ensure that you have consistent configurations across your entire environment, so you don't have any one-offs out there, right? You can ensure that they're all set up, configured exactly the same based on the kind of profiles that you set up ahead of time, right? So I think for larger environments, yeah, VMM is a great tool, but maybe not so much for the smaller ones.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with that. So you can get away with actually managing your Hyper-V environments without VMM. And I have one of my customers who's on here right now. I think we've got over 40 sites across the country, Clint, and we do everything manually. So we do everything through Hyper-V Manager and such. You know, the single pane of glass would be good, but at the end of the day, we were more interested in just the outright simplicity of the design and ease of use. Now, we're going to be moving into VMM. But what they've done for the last 3 to 4 years, they've actually managed everything manually themselves, and they feel very comfortable with that. And so now that they have a really good comfort level with the core tools, now is a great time to look at something that layers on top, because you're not really missing a bunch of pieces as to, you know, what the management stack is just layering on top, okay? So I got a couple of slides here that are just going to show what that configuration of the logical networks would look like inside of VMM, so a little bit different than what you'd see inside a Hyper-V Manager or PowerShell. So what we can do is say one connected network here and a logical network that's created, an independent or a private VLAN. So you could consider this would be like a private vSwitch, and these are just some different options that are kind of layering and stacking on top. You can choose which hosts or what networks to apply this to. So you can choose what VLANs are going to apply inside of this particular logical switch. So that's kind of neat, because I can actually get a nice graphical representation as to what my data center and what my network looks like. And then one of my favorite features of this, Clint, my absolute favorite features is, hey, networking team, can you please give me a pool of IP addresses that can be used to build new servers? We've got a little bit of IPAM, IP address management built into this sucker, and those can actually be automatically pushed down to my VMs as they're created. So that's pretty cool. So we can choose what site, we can choose IP address ranges, gateways, DNS, all of that good stuff, right? And then so once that's done, then we can take a look at configuring different things like, okay, what are my port uplinks going to look like? What are my port classifications going to look like? Is this something that's going to be, let's say that I've got a port classification for management servers and they need to be on a specific VLAN. Well, we can create port classifications for that stuff. And then you don't really have to worry about remembering how all of this stuff is configured. So you can provide that single pane of glass and really delegate administration under the covers without having to understand all of the moving parts. But you can't configure this stuff, guys. It doesn't work unless you understand the moving parts underneath as to what's actually going on. All right. So the physical network adapter configuration, you guys remember what we saw here? I'm just going to come back over to my demo machine here. You guys remember that this is kind of what our finished product looked like manually through PowerShell, right? This is basically the same type of finished product that you're going to look like through VMM. So as I get through these next couple of slides here, you're going to actually see this, okay? So we would just say that right here you can see the switch type that we're going to, or the teaming type that we're going to be having. So we want to have this set as switch independent teaming, okay? So what do you think this would be configuring, everyone? I'm pretty sure that this would be configuring our LBFO or Windows Team, right? So now that you can actually start to see what some of those pieces look like, it becomes a little easier to understand exactly what's going on. And that pull-down box would also have an option for LACP as well, okay? All right, so then we can see our different port, our different load balancing algorithms. Remember, guys, always, always, always just leave it to dynamic. That's the new way of doing this. That's our standard, so there's no real reason for you guys to change that. Then you can choose what networks are supposed to be supported, and that was through that logical network configuration that you guys saw earlier. Right, and then what we can do is we can just kind of finish the configuration here. Now, this is a really important one, virtual machine queuing, okay? So this one here, I've got a slide that's coming up on this. Virtual machine queuing, guys, is your friend to a certain extent, all right? There have been numerous articles that are out there on performance degradations with VM queuing, typically on 1 gig adapters. So I know that some of our guys that we're configuring right now, we do have 1 gig adapters. We're going to want to go through and check the support articles from Microsoft on this, because in certain cases, we have to disable VM queue.
Well, actually, by default, whenever you create the team with 1 gig NICs in it, VMQ is disabled, and there's a registry key that you have to go in and change to actually enable
VMQ
on 1 gig network.
Perfect. Okay. I'd forgotten about that. They had actually fixed that in R2 in 2012. It was a manual thing. So what happens, guys, causes really big instabilities in your infrastructure. All right. Okay. Clint, did you want to just talk real quick about like Serve.io? I'm picking all the things that Clint loves to talk about here.
Networking is my absolute weakest spot, and I can openly 100% admit that one.
So there's some benefits for connectivity through your virtual switches and stuff through single root virtualization. Your adapters and all of this have to support this stuff though, guys. So not all adapters are created to support these pieces, and you can almost go off in a separate session alone with enabling these pieces. I see a lot of manufacturers shipping stuff that actually doesn't even have this stuff turned on to start with. All right. Okay, so there's some advanced security features that you have in here. So these settings that you have in here, so you have max spoofing, DHCP, router guard, blah, 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 right? So if we take a look at our Hyper-V host, these settings here are going to actually be under the advanced options. So if we take a look here and come in down to my extensions, so there's a couple of extensions that you see in here. But you notice how all of those options that you have, not all of them are actually showing up and or are available for us, okay? And so you actually get some additional options that are available. You can't see everything in Hyper-V Manager, okay? So this is one of those things that when you have System Center Virtual Machine Manager, it actually allows you to do a few more things than the native tools will allow you to do, even with PowerShell. So, for example, I can't do network virtualization through, we've talked about yesterday, the network virtualization stack where we could have two subnets running at the same time. I can't do that natively in Hyper-V. I need VMM for this, and I need VMM for some of these additional advanced configurations, okay? All right. So VMM is not a bad thing for us. We just need to know and understand how to use it properly. We can also set network adapter port profiling quality of service settings, which is kind of cool. So if you want to rate limit some of those adapters, we can do that. And this is probably got two slides left where we're going to finish off with today. So do you guys remember my little drawing show and tell thing where I showed you that I was showing the adapters and how they only run through one CPU core. Well, watch what happens when you don't enable dynamic virtual machine queuing. What happens, all your networking traffic to all your VMs stacks up here. It stacks up into a single core. So you actually get bottlenecks inside of there. This CPU will just basically, if you're pushing a lot of traffic through Hyper-V without VMQ, you'll start to see this guy running up. And you can actually potentially see that core running up to 100%, right? Because it doesn't have enough horsepower to handle things. So VMQ is really simple, guys. I'm just going to load balance that out across multiple CPUs, okay? So VMQ is a really good thing. And then they have dynamic VMQ, which just has a little better load balancing algorithm, which can spread that load out a little bit better, okay? So VMQ is a good thing for you to have inside of your infrastructure. And what really takes advantage of a lot of this stuff is when we start to have 10 gig infrastructure, 40 gig infrastructure, and when we start to have stuff like 100 gig plus infrastructure, which, you know what? This is actually not that far away. A lot of the switches are actually shipping with 100 gig ports now. And, you know, what type of a box would leverage 100 gig connectivity? I'm pretty sure that Microsoft just released the fact that you could have like 20 plus terabytes of RAM in a single host server. Now, like I said, when you guys want to buy this server with 20 terabytes, Clint and I are more than happy to come configure that 100 gig infrastructure for you to back all that up and do some stress testing on it. No problem. All right. And here is our Serv.io. So Serv.io is basically a function that runs through the extensible Hyper-V virtual switch. And what it does is it allows a more efficient path for I.O. to come in and out of the system and or the networking stack for you. And for all intents and purposes, what ends up happening is that this traffic is going to take and is going to pass through very seamlessly. Now, if you don't have Serv.io and you don't have those functions, what will end up happening is you're going to have to take and pass back through the hypervisor a bit more. Okay. All right. Network quality of service capabilities. And I think, what time is it here? 2:22. I think we're probably good there, guys. I think that was a pretty good working session. I've got about 7-8 minutes left for some Q&A. If you guys want for Q&A, you can just unmute yourself, jump on, or if you want to just go through the chat window, we can do that, because I know yesterday we ran it a little long and didn't leave much time for some Q&A. So I guess my first question for you guys, did everybody learn a little something new? I hope so, because I know that every time that I do these things, I learn a little bit. So hopefully you guys were able to pick up a few new things going through that. Clint likes it when I do the networking sessions, because then he can take and pick up some new stuff. Clint can help out.
I can openly admit that this is my area for growth.
But you know what though, Clint? I think that's actually very common for my Windows administrators that are left having to take and a lot of my administrators, when they're talking about a software-defined networking or software-defined data centers, I think that this is probably pretty commonplace out there that, you know, a lot of us struggle with these pieces. I've been lucky enough, and the way that I learned this stuff, Clint, is I was forced to have to build this infrastructure end-to-end. I couldn't just hand off the baton, and that was what I found was really useful, because then you're digging in, I don't have a networking guy to actually go, you know, configure all this stuff for me. So it took a while to actually figure out what this looked like. And I'm actually very, very fortunate, Clint, to have the opportunity to work with one of my guys, Kerry Sun. He's actually been a CCIE for Cisco for the last 15 years. So pretty much anything network related, I can chuck over the fence and he's going to have some good answers for me. So.
Yeah. And I like Chad. No, it's not that I don't like being put on the spot there. It's just that, you know, whenever I was on your side of the fence, I had networking guys that did all the networking stuff for me, right? I was the guy that was in the vCenter server and in the console there, you know, configuring on the virtualization side of the fence. So I come from a kind of a Nexus switching infrastructure background. That's what we used whenever I was at Dix. We had Nexus gear all throughout, and we also utilized LACP as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so it looks like the Teravitas server team is exactly the same way. But, you know, so like as Dave said, traditionally the server admin doesn't get exposure to these types of things. So they get, I don't necessarily want to say, it's just not in their wheelhouse or in their area of responsibility. It isn't a hat that they have to put on every day. It's just like the light switch in IT that's always on. The network's always good, right? So I think it's good to get exposure to this types of discussions. So it's good to have that.
Yeah, and you know what? And especially when it comes to troubleshooting performance issues down the road, understanding what that stack looks like end to end is pretty important, right? Clint and I have delivered similar sessions like this around the world at, you know, various conferences. And I would have to say that the performance and the networking ones are always some of the most popular ones for my Windows admins, because it's a black hole for everybody. And the way that Microsoft defines and configures the networking stack through VMM is, I got to be quite frank, guys, is as clear as mud. I struggle going through there trying to remember where all of the stuff is inside of there. And so that's why when we build this infrastructure and you work with myself and Clint and our team, I start you at foundational levels, ground up, so you can actually see how this stuff is built properly. And you can see all the moving parts, because then the management layer on top is actually not that big of a deal. You don't just wonder where all these extra 1,000 adapters that show up in your server came from. All right. Well, I don't know that we've got any other questions, guys. I'm going to put the recording for today's session. I will put it in the same OneDrive folder, so the link that I had sent to you yesterday is going to be good to go for you. All right, so thanks everybody for joining us. Tomorrow's session, I think, Clint, we're actually going to start diving into some discussions on failover clustering, correct?
Awesome.
All right.
I believe that was the third module.
You bet. So, guys, thank you very much for taking the time to join us. Appreciate it. And we'll catch you guys tomorrow for the next session.